All right. And with that, I will hand it off to our presenters.
Good morning, everyone, or good morning or good afternoon, everyone. My name is Matthew Jefferson. I am the United States Environmental Protection Agency's Hazard Ranking System expert. And I'll pass this off to Chris.
Hello, Chris Robinson. I work with General Dynamics Information Technology, GDIT, and we assist EPA with all sorts of site as parts of their site assessment program for listing Superfund sites. Eric?
Hi, I'm Eric Boring. I'm a senior chemist that's involved, with, helping Chris out, and also I'm heavily involved in a lot of various aspects of data review. So, thank you.
Great. Well, so glad to see all of you here. Thank you, Chris and Eric, for your introductions here, and Renan for the introduction to the webinar. And again, great to see all of you here, and thank you for taking the time to attend this webinar. as Renan mentioned, we are here to talk a little bit about the updates that we have on one of our guidances here, the use of qualified data in HRS evaluations. Specifically, this webinar is for environmental professionals who are considering doing actions under the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, also known as CERCLA, or sometimes referred to as Superfund here. So for today's webinar, we are going to talk a little bit about the original 1996 fact sheet that came about, and then the revision to that fact sheet in 2022. We will also talk a little bit about adjustment factors, the UJ data, and some potential future updates that we might have to this fact sheet. And so, and if you are curious about getting the slides here or any of the references that both Chris and Eric are talking about, we have a list of resources that we're going to pop up here that talks of that, where you can get more information here. So for today, the qualified data fact sheet limitation, one thing that we're going to talk a little bit about here, this only applies to the HRS scoring evaluations, meaning that we are not necessarily talking about the use of this fact sheet in, say, the remedial program, or once the site goes into, once the site gets listed into on the NPL. This is specifically for consideration under the HRS. And so you might be asking, well, what is the HRS? That stands for the Hazard Ranking System. That system itself is a numerical scoring system that uses information from initial limited site investigation, or very small data sets here. Because those are very small data sets, this is the primary tool that EPA uses to determine if a site warrants placement on the National Priorities List, or the Superfund list that is commonly referred to here. So, just a quick recap for those who are not familiar with the HRS, how does it work? So basically, the HRS is a sort of rough and oversimplified model that evaluates the point. It's an evaluation of a point-based scoring factors to produce what we would consider a score for that particular site. If the score exceeds a certain threshold, then that particular site is eligible for the Superfund list, or the National Priorities List, or the NPL. And that score, those scoring factors are assigned based on a couple of different site characteristics. So one is about population, you know, the number of people that are there or sensitive environments that might be affected. Another one considers how much, like, either volume or the amount of waste that is at that particular site. Another consideration is the toxicity, the mobility, or whether or not those contaminants are persistent over a period of time. And then, has that contamination escaped into the environment? And it could be multiple different media or a single media that's talking about either water, soil, air, those types of things. And thinking about the release or the, you know, the contamination being escaped, that last factor is oftentimes talked about the observed release here. So we do what we do in as far as when we document this, we do a comparison of those background results to the release. So we're comparing the background and the release. And if that difference is significant, we call that an observed release. So I'm going to go ahead and hand this off to Eric, who's going to lead us into the next module.
Oops, sorry. Just making sure getting on the right screen. Thanks, Matt. So let's take a look at the original fact sheet. So this fact sheet was used by EPA as an approach to treat the qualified analytical results in an HRS site evaluation, or plural, sorry. When the prospective Superfund sites are scored, an HRS documentation record is produced to document the scoring. And we typically will cite this fact sheet in that documentation record and include it in the package of references. And these fact sheet procedures we'll be talking about can be applied to both data from EPA CLP labs, a contract laboratory program labs, and non-CLP labs. And I'm going to stress this a little bit. This fact sheet applies specifically to water and soil samples, okay? Now, oftentimes you can apply the procedures for soils to sediments because they're often very similar. In other solid matrices, it may not be so, clear cut. So whenever there's a doubt, you can, reach out to EPA headquarters and see what they say about it. Okay, so here's a recap of how the 1996 fact sheet worked. We have these adjustment factors that we use to adjust the validator qualified data. And these adjustment factors are listed in the fact sheets in tables towards the end of that document. And these factors are specific to both the analyte and the matrix. This adjustment process we're going to be talking about is used for HRS scoring data where there's some sort of quantitative comparison you can make between the contaminated sample results and the background. So, let's see,
Okay, and thanks, Eric. I'll take this one here, and we'll just touch really quickly on a little bit more of the origin and the purpose of the adjustment factors. The fact sheet itself, it has a description of the factors, their derivation, and their purpose. But just at the high level, they're used for qualified data that might be involved with some high bias, low bias, or unknown bias. And when we talk about unknown bias, we mean qualified results that are associated with QC issues that might involve high or low bias, or both, where there might be multiple issues. The factors themselves are just a rough management tool to help address analytical uncertainty that the data qualifiers might imply. And they're sort of there to help ensure that in spite of any of the kind of additional uncertainty in the background or contaminated results that we're comparing, that there's still decent confidence that the significant difference between those two is real. And as the fact sheet explains, the adjustment factors were developed by looking at large analytical data sets from the CLP program. We're talking thousands or tens of thousands of data points. And percent recovery was data was collected from that big pool from several different types of QC samples, matrix spikes, surrogates, lab control samples, etc. And then for each analyte and matrix, percent recovery data was evaluated, outliers were thrown out, and then the range of that remaining percent recovery data was assessed. And the ratio of the upper and lower bounds of that percent recovery data was used to determine each adjustment factor. So that means that the factors represent roughly the approximate upper and lower bounds of anticipated QC performance for an analyte. And because of that, the fact that they represent this range of the highest recoveries to the lowest recoveries, that means that the factors are fairly conservative, meaning fairly large numbers. Now, they're not designed to pull a qualified sample result from the low or high end of recovery to 100% recovery, but instead they sort of likely slightly overcompensate as a conservative measure. And so as far as application goes, the factors get applied to qualified results in a fairly simple scenario. Essentially, adjustment can only move results in the direction that would reduce the gap between background and release. So again, unknown bias results, we want to remember that those are where there's not a specific direction of bias. Those are treated as though they might entail both low and high bias. So if we have low or unknown bias background results, those are adjusted up, multiplied by the adjustment factor. And high bias release or contaminated results are adjusted down, divided by those adjustment factors. And essentially, this adjustment process, it only makes it more difficult to document that an observed release has happened, that the contaminated release results are significantly higher than background. So what does that mean? Well, in a nutshell, dividing the high bias release result by this adjustment factor sort of roughly deflates it from the high end of the expected performance bounds toward the low end of those bounds and generates this projected minimum release result value. And conversely, multiplying a low bias background result by the adjustment factor inflates it from the low end of the bounds toward the high end, generating a projected maximum background result value. And it's a fairly conservative way to help show that any of the remaining significant increase between background and release results is still strongly documented, even though there might have been some additional uncertainty imparted by on the lab results by the QC issues. And when is this process used? Well, it's typically applied to qualified data that's used in quantitative comparisons for these HRS purposes. That's usually the comparison of background and release samples or background and contaminated samples as part of establishing an observed release or observed contamination in HRS speak. But they can also be applied and have been in the past to qualified source data when the source samples are compared to background. So most often the sources of contamination that are evaluated by the HRS, they're characterized by waste samples to document contaminants in those sources. But for example, where the HRS source being evaluated might be contaminated soil or some other more naturally occurring medium, the source sample results can be compared to background just to show sort of a relative increase in those contaminants, those chemicals. And in that case, the adjustment factors can be applied there if qualified data is involved. So I'll hand it off to Eric. He's going to take us through a few quick knowledge check exercises on what we just talked about.
Thanks, Chris. Oh, yay, Chris, quiz time, right? So before we move on to the updated fact sheet, let's go through a few scenarios where we illustrate the adjustment principles. So here we have, Here we have two results being compared to establish observed contamination. And I'll just make that requirement. You've heard the term significantly above. Where for HRS purposes, we look for three times, at least three times, having the release sample being at least three times the background level to establish an observed release. So in this case, we've got the background soil sample with a TCE result that's 12 microgram per kilogram. It's got a J plus flag that was applied by the validator, and that indicates high bias. So let's put an actual QC issue here we can use as an example. So let's say like a high LCS recovery, laboratory control sample recovery was associated with that background sample. And then in the release sample, the result was 40 microgram per kilogram. It's got a J minus validator flag, and that indicates low bias. So perhaps there's a low surrogate recovery in that sample. Okay. So question is, should the results be adjusted? And there are a number of possible outcomes here, which I'll share with you here, A through D. And we'll pause a few seconds to let you have a think about it and come up with your answer. So the answer is A, you adjust neither the background nor the release. Because remember, the background is already biased high, so you don't need to adjust that. And the release sample is already biased low, so again, no adjustment needed for that one. So, and then you could look at the two values now, the take the unadjusted values and do that little calculation, multiply the background sample by three, and you see it's below the release sample. So you could use this data to establish observed release. Okay, let's move on to another test scenario. So in this case, you've got the background soil sample. Again, it's got a 12 microgram per kilogram result. But this time it was flagged J minus by the validator, indicating a low bias, maybe a low matrix spike recovery. The release sample is 30 microgram per kilogram, but there's no bias associated with all the QC was fine with that one. So what do you do? Should the results be adjusted? So again, same options here. Give you some time to think about it. So, in this case, the two results being compared this time were slightly different. The background soil sample, all right, so, see, you can see that the answer is that you adjust the background only. Let me just, because the background's low biased. And so what we're going to do here is adjust that result, that initial result, with the analyte matrix adjustment factor you see here, 2.11, that you get from the fact sheet. Okay, so when you do that, you get the estimated, or what Chris referred to, the projected maximum background result. Okay, and then for the release sample, it's not biased, so no adjustments needed. So now you would compare, to establish an observed release, you would compare the release sample result that was unadjusted, the 30, to the adjusted background result. And you don't see that, you know, the release sample is not three times or greater than of the background. So we couldn't use this data to establish observed release. And finally, let's see, the third example here, we have, again, a background. This time it's a water sample. The TC value is 15 microgram per liter. No bias for that one. The released water sample, though, result was 70 microgram per liter. Validator gave it a J plus. Maybe there was a high matrix spike recovery associated with that. So what should we do here? Same four options. All right. So here, you would only adjust the release sample because, you know, it's high bias. And so you would take that initial result, the 70 microgram per liter, and look up the analyte matrix adjustment factor for TCE in the fact sheet. You see it was 1.66, divide by that number to get your estimated minimum release result, or projected minimum result, as Chris referred to earlier. Don't have to do anything to the background because it's not biased. All the QC was fine. So then now we can compare the adjusted release sample to the background and see that it just barely below that criteria, just barely below three times. So you wouldn't be able to use this either. Okay, so I think I'm going to hand it over to Chris here.
Right, so we'll just stop here for a second before we move on to the new fact sheet and look at just a few notes on the scope and applicability. We just want to make sure that everybody's on the same page as far as the limitations of the fact sheet. So first here, these procedures, these adjustment procedures, they're just a tool to very roughly compensate for bias in these sample results. They really only generate these projected estimated minimum release sample values, or projected estimated maximum background values for HRS scoring. And this really usually only applies to IDing of observed release, observed contamination, or observed exposure, these three HRS processes. Or occasionally it can be used in associating hazardous substances with an HRS source for scoring purposes. And really there it should only be considered if the source data is being compared to background data in some sort of quantitative manner. The adjustment process is not correction. It's not a correction of the flag result to its air quotes true value. This isn't a process like recovery correction. The result itself, the adjusted result, is not a new final value in some way, and it doesn't replace the original lab result. It's just existing solely in the HRS documentation record and just for the purpose of this HRS process of establishing observed releases. The lab result is still the official result for that sample. And finally, maybe this will be the last time we say it, but this fact sheet only applies to an HRS evaluation. It's not intended for any other process. And with that, I'll hand it back to Eric, and he's going to take us from the realm of the 96 fact sheet into the new fact sheet.
All right. Thanks, Chris. All right. So what's changed? Okay. So I should start by saying that the bulk of the fact sheet did not change. So the, you know, the core of the adjustment scenarios and the recommendations, those are the same. They remained intact, but several other elements were revised. Like we did some basic housekeeping. We revised or updated some of the references that were cited, trying to, you know, reflect the most currently available documents. We, you know, updated the definitions. In some cases, some of the data qualifier definitions had had changed over the years. And so we updated them to align with current definitions and, you know, EPA's primary validation guidance for CLP data. That's the National Functional Guidelines for Data Review. We made some clarifications to some minor text, you know, issues and some couple corrections of technical statements that we'll talk about. And there were a couple updates to clarify and revise the default adjustment factor of 10 and also how we were to treat UJ flag results. All right, so let's see here. So briefly touch on some of these here. As far as the housekeeping level updates, you know, I mentioned again, we modernized some of the reference citation. We aligned the flag definitions with current NFG guidelines, National Functional Guidelines. Then for the results between the detection limit and the quantitation limit, we wanted to clarify some of the associated language. So in the old fact sheet, it was implied in some way that the results below the quantitation limit aren't usable, couldn't use those. But that's not completely accurate. You know, for background samples used in establishing the observed release, the HRS actually allows using results all the way down to the detection limit. So for J flags attached to the prospective background sample results detected between the DL detection limit and the quantitation limit, the new fact sheet clarifies that if the only reason that J flag was applied was due to being between the detection and quantitation limit, and there's no actual QC failure involved, then those DL to QL J flags could be considered no bias situations for the purpose of the fact sheet. You know, the rationale there is, yes, results below the quantitation limit are slightly fuzzier than results above the quantitation limit. But because no real QC failure was observed, it's likely much less bias or uncertainty associated with that value than if there was some QC failure in play. Next, the new fact sheet touches on qualifiers for field QC failures, not just lab QC failures. So now we added the field QC failures. You know, these are flags associated with failures for things like field blanks, field duplicates, trip blanks, if you have volatiles. And then because the 1996 fact sheet wasn't perfectly clear on this, the new fact sheet states that the adjustment factors and adjustment procedures can indeed be applied to data with these types of qualifiers. Finally, the new fact sheet clarifies that the adjustment procedures can be applied to source data, where that source data might include contaminated samples that are being compared to background samples, appropriate background samples. You know, this might more often be the situation for naturally occurring contaminants like metals in a natural or semi-natural medium like soil or mine tailings mixed with soil, et cetera. All right, let's see. And now I'm going to turn it over to Chris to talk about the default of 10.
Great, thanks. So now that we've gone through sort of the brief explanation list there, we'll focus in on just a couple of the slightly more complex changes to the fact sheet. And first is the fact sheet's default adjustment factor of 10. So as we talked about before, the adjustment factors were originally derived using percent recovery data from these large, large CLP data sets. And where there wasn't enough or was no recovery data available, the fact sheet specified a default adjustment factor of 10 can be applied. EPA found that 10 would be a relatively conservative number, that is relatively high, a relatively big number, based on the population of the adjustment factors that they'd calculated from that percent recovery data, based on the, you know, the full range of those adjustment factors. The 96 fact sheet listed the 10 in the factor tables itself and discussed using it when an analyte-specific adjustment factor wasn't available. But it was not absolutely clear exactly the scope of when the 10 should be used. So in the new fact sheet, that angle has been clarified. So the default 10 can essentially be applied in any situation where an analyte and matrix-specific factor isn't provided. So for any analyte not listed in the tables, like dioxins or PFAS compounds, etc., you can use the 10. For analytes from other types of methods not involved in the methods listed in the analyte tables, methods that are, say, very different from the CLP methods that were involved in the derivation of the adjustment factors, and the 10 could be applied to any matrix that isn't listed. And remember that the tables currently cover liquid or aqueous samples, solid soil samples. So the default 10 could be used for qualified air data, soil gas data, etc. And our final little focus topic here will be everyone's favorite UJ data. And before we get into it, we just want to take a step back and look and review what the typical UJ flag means for CLP data as it's validated under the National Functional Guidelines. Now, in the HRS evaluations, these UJ results always appear as prospective background samples, sample results. They almost always start life as a non-detect result, a result where the measurement or signal fell below the equivalent of the detection limit. And under the CLP, the non-detects are reported by the lab with a U flag, as you all probably know, accompanied by the SQL, the sample quantitation limit, or the CRQL in CLP. But somewhere along the way, for this non-detect result, there's some sort of QC failure that implies a possible low bias. This could be a low bias failure like low spike recovery, or a failure associated with unknown bias, like an RPD failure for duplicates. And as we mentioned before, unknown bias, of course, includes the possibility of low or high bias. But it's the possibility of low bias involved that's the important bit here. So all of this results in the validator changing the U flag to a final flag of UJ to ID the issue. And what is the issue? The implied issue there with a UJ is that while the measured signal was below the equivalent of the detection limit, the true value of the result, if the QC issue hadn't affected things, might have been some higher value. So to recap there, in CLP data, UJ is almost always a result that was non-detect with some associated low bias. And in HRS evaluations, these are almost or are always results that might be considered for background. And as we note here, there's all sorts of validation and flagging and qualifying schemes outside of our typical CLP data validated under the NFG. CLP NFG style validated data and qualifiers is what almost always serves as the input for HRS evaluations, but it's always good to be aware that Qualifier definitions and flagging can vary from program to program or organization to organization. So like with any data qualifier for any particular U flag result or UJ flag result, it's always a good idea to double check and make sure that the qualifier means what you think it does. So in the original fact sheet, in the 96 fact sheet, UJ results were treated in a way that made them somewhat generally not usable, at least in practice. And this was maybe based on older and alternative types of UJ flags. But the 96 fact sheet set up these criteria here for using UJs. One, that confidence that the UJ background isn't detectable above the CRQL or SQL if it's not CLP data. Two, a criterion that the UJ result is high biased. And three, a criterion that the associated release sample, the sample that might be compared to the UJ background, criterion that that release sample result is at or above the CRQL. But with the normal modern UJ flagged result, as we just talked about, it would never meet that second criterion, since under normal, modern, current validation systems, the UJ flag data involves low bias, not high bias. And also the first criterion there was a little bit vague, given that the typical UJ was a lab measurement falling below the detection limit. So that slight misalignment of the way that the 96 fact sheet was treating things with current UJ qualifiers meant that, unfortunately, there were times when UJ data that could have been helpful couldn't be used in HRS evaluations. So in the new fact sheet, things have been revised to reflect the current UJ flagging systems and sort of clarify a more reasonable way to deal with this data. Language was added to the fact sheet to describe the UJ results, so everybody's clear about what we're talking about in the way that we just discussed. The fact sheet clarifies that UJ results are generally usable in HRS evaluations, and roughly they can be used among the pool of prospective background sample results unadjusted and being treated in essence like a normal non-detect. The rationale there is that though those UJ results may have had some low bias associated with the original measurement, the measurement itself was below the detection limit. And there's typically some distance between the DL and QL, the detection limit and quantitation limit, usually a factor of three or more. And so we should note quickly here for HRS purposes, when HRS evaluations are being done where non-detects are used to help set the background level for establishing an observed release, the non-detect background sample QL quantitation limit is used for a comparison to release sample results. That's part of the HRS regulatory criteria for observed releases. And so how does this actually get applied? In the new fact sheet, we have specific procedures for UJs. It's fairly simple. We can use the UJ result, assuming it meets that normal definition of a UJ that we talked about, among the pool of background results for selection of background levels. If the QL is available, then a SQL or a CRQL if it's CLP data, then we treat the UJ flag result as just a normal non-detect. No adjustment or other process is needed there. And if the QL isn't available, then we use the detection limit. Usually that's the sample-specific MDL method detection limit. And we'll multiply that detection limit by three to produce a surrogate quantitation limit. Since quantitation limits are usually set roughly three times the detection limit. This sort of gives us a stand-in for the QL that we don't have so that we can use that result in selecting background levels and determining HRS observed release criteria. So with that, I'll hand it back to Eric to discuss, you know, how we would actually go about presenting some of this data in the doc record.
Thank you, Chris. So those of you in the audience involved in or that will be involved in preparing HRS documentation records, you can present these UJ background results in the document and very similarly to present other tabulated qualified data. So first you'll want to have a data table footnote that defines the UJ qualifier. Then you'll want to define the associated direction of bias. For the typical UJ, this is going to be low or maybe unknown bias, depending on the information you get from the data validation reports. And then finally, you'll want a footnote to clarify whether the limit presented alongside the UJ is a quantitation or detection limit. All right. Then in your HRS documentation record data tables, you can present the original result, so in this case, the three UJ, and alongside it, in the parenthetical, the three with a U now. So essentially, we're saying that we're treating this UJ, essentially like a non-detect, reported at the, well, actually, we don't know in this case, but anyways, reported at some level. So let's take the second one. If the original result was three UJ, okay, so that first one was referring to the three is a sample quantitation limit. So you would use the three there. For the second result, if the three is a detection limit and the SQL is not available, then what you would do is you would multiply that method detection limit by three to get your stand-in or surrogate quantitation limit. So you'd present it with the original result, three UJ, and then the parenthetical, the adjusted result multiplied by three, nine, with the followed by the U flag. Okay, final part of the quizzes here. So let's try example here, UJ scenario. Let's see. So you've got a background sample that's 12 microgram per kilogram. It's associated with the UJ flag, and that UJ flag is because of low bias, maybe low matrix spike recovery again. The SQL in this case is known. It's 12 microgram per kilogram. The release sample is 30 microgram per kilogram, and no bias is associated with that one. So how should the UJ be treated in this case? Give you your choices. Okay, give you a few seconds to think about it. All right. So this is a typical low bias UJ. So you treat it as a non-detect. And because the quantitation limit is available, we can present the result as 12 microgram per kilogram with that original UJ. And then in the parenthetical, 12 microgram per kilogram with the U. And again, this 12 is, you know, represents the SQL in this case. All right. Last one, I promise. Okay. So here we've got the background sample, the low level of 3 microgram per kilogram with a UJ flag, low bias, maybe low surrogate recovery in this case. The MDL was given as 3 microgram per kilogram. And we don't have an SQL in this case. And the release sample no bias associated with it, and the result is 30 microgram per kilogram. How should the UJ be treated in this case? So there's your, oops, I gave you the answer, but I guess we're kind of running short on time, so I will just tell you the answer. In this case, we would treat UJ as a non-detect, multiply it by, and multiply that MDL by 3 to get your stand-in SQL in this case of 9 microgram per kilogram. All right. And I'm going to let Chris talk about what we might expect in the future.
Thanks a bunch. And just to leave some time for Q&A, I'll hop through these very quickly. So these are a few possible future updates. These aren't set in stone and there's no timeline, but these are some things that EPA might consider looking into down the road here. As we mentioned, the current fact sheet only has specific adjustment factors for aqueous and soil or solid samples, but not for air. And that means that currently the only adjustment factor for air is the 10, which, as we discussed, is a relatively conservative or high value. So EPA might consider looking into evaluation of air data to see if analyte-specific and air-specific adjustment factors could be derived. And given the sort of cleaner matrix that is air, it's highly likely that that would translate to tighter percent recovery ranges and factors that would be a fair bit lower than the default of 10. And then finally here for soil and water matrices, EPA might consider looking to go back and update those, recalculate those based on newer pools of data. And that may or may not result in, changes to substantive changes to the analyte-specific factors, but would just represent at least an update of the data pool used to derive those factors. And with that, I'll thank all of you for listening in to our little technical talk here. And looks like we might have just a little time left for questions, if there are any. And I'll hand it back to Renan, our moderator.
All right. Thank you so much, Chris, Eric, and Matt. That was great. So yeah, we'll jump right into the Q&A. The first question that came in was from Ying Wang. Lab reported results are often directly used in the data analysis. What are the underlying reasons for EPA developing this adjustment approach for HRS for other applications? Or do you want to just do that first one first?
This is just a, as mentioned, it's just a sort of a rough and blunt tool to deal to some extent with the small additional uncertainties that might be injected into the data. So when EPA is scoring a site, a prospective Superfund site, and conducting these HRS specific evaluations where we're comparing a background to release sample results or a pool of background results to a pool of release sample results, if some of them are qualified, this just gives EPA a tool to roughly compensate in some way for the possible bias that might be included in some of those results. And again, it's not an attempt to do something like recovery correction, because typically at this stage, the pool of data that any prospective Superfund site has as the result of an SI, a site inspection, is not a large number of samples and results. So there's typically not enough results available to do some sort of statistical correction. So that's the purpose of the adjustment factors.
I see. Does this apply to any other lab results, not HRS, used in the EPA?
This fact sheet, the adjustment procedures and adjustment factors are solely intended for just this little slice of the Superfund process during the HRS evaluation.
Okay. So the next question, some quick definitions. What is UJ and what is J? Just for real new people.
These are data qualifiers. So after laboratory data is produced, laboratories always run certain specified quality control samples. And if those control samples show that things aren't going perfectly, the data before it's used, typically before it's used for HRS purposes, goes through a validation process, and the validator looks back at the laboratory QC samples. And if there are some quality control failures involved, the validator can flag the environmental sample results. And a typical flag is J. You might see J plus or J minus, but J means that this result is not perfect. It's still usable, but there's some potential bias involved with it. J typically means unknown bias. J plus will mean high bias. J minus will mean low bias. And then UJ, as we discussed, very roughly means a result that was not detected originally. The measured signal was below the detection limit, but that non-detect result was associated with some low bias.
Okay, thank you. Okay, another quick definition question. What does SQL and CRQL stand for?
SQL is sample quantitation limit, and CRQL is the contract required quantitation limit. So sample quantitation limit is the limit typically above the detection limit at a place where there's a higher level in quantitative accuracy, you know, the exact number that's being reported, as opposed to the detection limit, which is a presence-absence sort of concentration, where there's a confidence in presence or absence of the analyte. And then the CRQL, the contract required quantitation limit, it's an SQL for the CLP program, the contract laboratory program that EPA has. So it's a little bit more like a reporting limit than a laboratory-specific quantitation limit.
Okay. Thank you. We have another question from Ying Wang. For example, because UJ is a low bias, why not apply the analyte-specific adjustment factor?
For UJ results, the issue there would be that the UJ results start as non-detects, which means they don't have a reported measured result. They'll be reported under the CLP program with a U flag, which means non-detect, some signal below the detection limit, and then sitting next to that U flag, meaning non-detect, will be the quantitation limit, or CRQL if it's in the CLP program. So those UJ results, they don't technically have a reported, in a sense, measured result that you could use to adjust.
Okay. All right, thank you. Okay, so I have one last question. This is more of a clarification. So did I understand correctly that one of the fact sheet clarifications states release samples between the DL and the SQL qualified J can be used and compared to 3 times maximum background We usually treat release at, or source sample concentrations below the SQL as non-detect.
For source samples, that is not strictly part of HRS requirements, and so there, you professional judgment and inquiry with EPA headquarters would be involved. But no, there was we may have slightly misspoken there, but just to clarify, for a release sample, the commenter is correct. For the release concentration, that has to be at or above the QL per HRS requirements. The background sample results that can be used as part of playing the observe release game, the test to see if an observe release can be established, background results are usable at the DL, the detection limit, and above. And that's also not a fact sheet specification. That comes directly from the HRS itself. And that was a point that the old fact sheet was slightly confusing on.
Great. Thank you so much, Chris. And thank you to all the other presenters, Eric and Matt and Jean Ballant, helping me out in the background. And thank you all for attending today. We're going to close out now. So if you enjoyed this webinar, you found it helpful, please go to cluin.org and look for upcoming webinars, technical guides, resources like the ones mentioned during this presentation. And, if you want to be regularly updated on these upcoming webinars and resources, please subscribe to TechDirect, shown at that link. You can also find that at Cluin. So I'll just do some reminders again. When you registered for today's seminar, you should have received a confirmation email with instructions to join us for the live event. We also sent the same details in a reminder email yesterday. Those emails will both point you towards the seminar homepage you can see on the screen. The seminar homepage is active from today forward, so I encourage you to save it. There are many important pieces of information, including the session description, biographical information for our presenters, links to download presentation materials, as well as options to browse through related websites. There is even an option to provide feedback after our live delivery. Remember, this link will be available from day forward. To join us in the live broadcast, simply click the red button labeled Join Webinar, and you'll be prompted to fill out our brief check-in form to join us for the live delivery. Upon completing that form, you will receive the details to connect to the webinar in progress. Please read the instructions on that screen carefully, as it will provide additional options should you have any difficulty joining us in the live broadcast. All right. So we often receive requests for PDHs and CEUs, but do not offer these hours for our events. Instead, you can download or print our participation certificate after submitting your feedback. Please be sure to enter your email address correctly and check the box at the bottom of the form certifying you attended the live or replayed the event. Immediately upon submitting the form, you can download or print your certificate. All right. So thank you for joining us. Let me thank the presenters again and for their time and expertise, as well as the organizers, Jean Ballant, helped out and put together today's session along with support staff who carry out our live delivery. Last but not least, let me thank each and every one of you for joining our live session today. We hope you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that you will join us for the future session. With that, I will formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you.